ain't getting moved. I don't care who it is. Let's go. Give me everything you got.
Play fast, play hard. Let's beat these boys tonight in their house.
It's party time. It's party time.
Dad, here we go.
Touchdown.
Welcome into another week of the Eagle Eye in the Sky Football Podcast. I'm your host, Fran Duffy. Joining me, as he does each and every week, NFL Film Senior Producer Greg Cosell. Greg, a tough loss for the Eagles this week in Week 14 against the Seattle Seahawks. The defending Super Bowl champions came to Lincoln Financial Field. It was a tough game for the Eagles, at least on the offensive side of the ball. Defensively, I think they more than held their own. What did you see when you watched the film Monday morning? We'll start with the Eagles' offense.
Yeah, I think it was a game in which the quality of defensive player on the Seahawks was just better overall than the Eagles' offense. And one thing I thought going in was that the Seahawks would play some man coverage, maybe a little more than usual. I don't have exact numbers, but they clearly played man coverage. It was evident on the first drive where the Eagles threw it three times. I think the Seahawks played man twice, and one time they played zone, but it was always has man concepts in their zone. And it was evident to me right away, even watching the game with you on Sunday, that the Eagles would struggle to throw the ball. And the reality was when they played man, Macklin struggled to get open against Sherman. Matthews had a hard time working against Maxwell.
I thought Maxwell was one of the best players in the league. He had a great game on Sunday.
And Cooper really had a hard time against Simon. So they really could not generate much offensively. And I'll tell you what was interesting to me. And I know a lot of people that I talked to thought the Eagles could actually get on the perimeter in the run game, and they tried that. So obviously Chip Kelly felt the same way. To be honest, Fran, I thought that was a little surprising. I didn't think they would be able to run to the perimeter because having watched the Seahawk defense, they're a very fast flow defense, very reactive. And as we saw in the game, the Eagles really had a hard time running to the perimeter.
Yeah, I was surprised. You know, I think – you know, looking back on my notes from last week and just, you know, general preparation for the game, I didn't think that they were going to come in and run for 250, 300 yards, but I kind of thought that they'd be able to move the ball on the ground more so than what they did. Now, I don't know if I expected, because that defense, it might be the fastest in the NFL. It's definitely the fastest that I watched all season long with the sweeps and some of those outside runs. Like you mentioned, they did have some issues. I was surprised maybe there wasn't as much of the inside zone and some of those between the tackles runs. Although, look, I may have underestimated these guys. You know, Kevin Williams and McDaniel. I mean, those guys, I said Maxwell was one of the best players in the field.
Right.
Williams was outstanding. McDaniel had a great game as well.
Yeah, and I think, look, we know what LeSean McCoy is. He's a dynamic space runner. And I think when you play Seattle, you've got to be willing to stick it up in there and get 2 yards or 3 yards, whatever it is. But against Seattle, if you get caught in second and long and third and long, it's really tough to play. Now, you can say that we know about any defense any week, but Seattle last year had an historic defense. And this year, since Wagner came back about 3 weeks ago and Chancellor is now healthy, the defense is back playing at an extremely high level. Don't forget, one of the Eagles' touchdowns came off the punt botch. So they didn't really have long drives. They had the one touchdown to Ertz. And I know we talked about it before the podcast, but it came on a play that they ran a number of times.
Yeah.
It was a mirrored post-wheel combination. And on the other side was Matthews. He was the slot guy who ran the wheel. And I think they ran it 4 times, and 3 times he was wide open.
Yep.
And the 4th time they played it better, and Sanchez wouldn't have been able to get it to Matthews. But it's just something interesting. That's when you play a lot of single high cover 3 like that, that's an area of the field that's difficult for that defense to handle.
Yeah, no question about it. And obviously the one of the first times they ran it was the touchdown to Ertz.
Right, right.
Where Ertz was the one that was running.
And
the
that was
wheel
man
route
on that side of the field.
Yep.
So they had, I believe Maxwell was playing Cooper, I believe
yep,
it was.
And it was Wagner on Ertz.
It was Wright, I believe.
Oh, was it Wright?
I believe
it was one
Wright.
Of the two, yeah.
But they got the linebacker on him, and it was that's what they wanted.
Yeah, no question about it. So that was one of the interesting things we saw in the pass game. In the run game, there was one interesting thing. Did you notice the counter to the inside zone counter?
It was almost like a double misdirection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It worked a couple times.
Because we saw against Dallas, and we'll get into that game in a minute, we saw them against Dallas. It was the 4th play of the game, McCoy's 36-yard run, which was sort of a misdirection off the inside zone. This was kind of misdirection off the misdirection off the inside zone.
Yeah, right.
And that was the long run of the day for 10 yards.
Yeah, no question. And they had a couple of them that I think another one went for 7 or 6, and then another one went
right.
for 5 or 6 as well. So they were able to have some success with that. It'll be interesting to see whether or not they take advantage of that moving forward, because they hit the Cowboys on that inside zone counter a couple of times
right.
on Thanksgiving. So, you know, adding another layer to the onion, that is the Eagles' rushing attack. So,
right.
Very interesting to see that. Defensively, I mean, I put in my article earlier this week, Fletcher Cox and Michael Kendricks were just outstanding from start to finish
right.
in the game. Obviously, a number of these guys up front were very good. I thought Benny Logan had another good game. Sed Thornton, did his normal thing. Connor Barwin as well. But really, I mean, the defense, they were on the field for, I believe it was 91 plays they were on the field for. Given the circumstances against a quarterback like Russell Wilson that presents so many challenges, and a guy like Marshawn Lynch, I didn't look at the numbers, but had to be one of his lowest outputs of the season, I would think. You got to give them props.
And I think that we talked last week leading up to the game, and I mentioned the stat about Wilson in the previous 6 games before the Eagles,
right.
that he'd averaged 8 improvisational plays per game in the previous 6, and scrambles and scramble throws. In this game, he had 12 for 96 yards, and 9 of them, I believe, were passes. So, ultimately, that's what Seattle's offense has become.
Right.
It's become, in many ways, the big plays in particular come off Wilson movement, and there were times the Eagles did a very good job, and there were other times they didn't. And those are usually back-breaking type plays when you don't stop those plays. But on a number of plays, they did a very good job.
Ironically, the only 3 big plays that I can think of that that Seattle was able to connect on were the 3 touchdowns. You had the double move from Doug Baldwin in the slot,
which was zero coverage,
exactly, against zero coverage, which was it was a great route. I mean, Malcolm Jenkins, I don't know what else that he could have done in that route. It was a great route from Baldwin. You had the zone read from Russell Wilson, and then you had the throwback on the to inside
Lynch.
The red zone to Lynch.
That was a design play.
Yeah, and
yeah.
they've run that a few times.
Yeah.
But it's tough to defend because of all the boot action, all the different things that they do.
Right.
And it's those 3 plays were the 3 that I can think of. And again, I'd have to go back and look at this. They're the only 3 plays that I can think of off the top of my head where they were able to create something in structure, outside of structure,
right.
where most of those 3rd down and long plays that they were able to
yep.
connect on.
And, of course, look, it's always easy to pick out 1 or 2 plays in every game.
Yep.
But I think the one that the Eagles will look back on, if need be, if they end up having to go to Seattle in the playoffs, of course, is Malcolm Jenkins dropping the interception,
yep.
which would have been a pick 6.
Right.
And that would have made it 24-21, I believe, with about 7 or 8 minutes
yep.
to go. And it would have changed the tenor of the game going down the stretch.
Yeah, no question. Between that play and then the interception after the Lynch fumble,
right.
you would think that those 2 plays, that absolutely changes the outcome of the game. All right, so let's kind of put a bow on Seattle. We'll move. It's obviously Dallas week. We saw this team, what is it now, 10 days ago at this point?
Thanksgiving.
Two weeks ago.
The 27th of November,
so
I believe.
It wasn't long ago.
No.
So we've spent a lot of time talking about this team, whether it was preparing for Dallas or in the aftermath of what was a huge win for the Eagles on Thanksgiving Day. What did you see from Dallas against Chicago last week? Obviously, they weren't challenged on the offensive
no.
side of the ball.
No, and I think that was the kind of game Dallas wants to play.
Yep.
Murray ended up with 32 carries. Now, many of those came in the second half. I think he had 16. I think it was 16 and 16 now that I think about it. But he had more yards in the second half. He had 3 long runs. Romo was not asked to do a lot. Quite frankly, watching the tape of their offense, I don't think Romo threw the ball real well.
I got that sense as well.
I think the ball lost energy. I mean, even the 43-yard completion to Dez Bryant, you remember that play?
Right, yep.
That ball hung.
Mm-hmm.
That lost energy on the back end.
Yeah, I would agree.
And I think Romo, at this point, he may have some arm strength limitations. Now, he never had a gun, but he had a pretty good arm.
Yep.
And I think right now, whether it's his back, whether it's just whatever the reason, I don't think the ball's coming out real well.
Yeah, it's interesting that talking with some of the guys that I work with around the building, we had the Eagles Insider podcast earlier today with Chris McPherson and Bo Wolf. Those guys brought up, Romo's coming off a lot of rest, and it's like, when we played them on Thanksgiving, he was 2 weeks removed from the bye week, and the week earlier they had played New York, the Giants, where the Giants couldn't touch him. I mean, he was upright for the entirety of that game. He was pretty healthy going into that
right.
game as well, theoretically. So it'll be really interesting to see how he looks off of 10 days rest. And really, how he's able to prepare. If they decide to change some things in the pass game, I would imagine that coming into this week, they're going to find some different ways to get the ball possibly to Jason Witten, to Dez Bryant, because they really struggled.
Well, they
doing
tried.
That a little bit.
You know, it's funny. I think it might have been the fourth or fifth play of the first game. It was 2nd and 7.
Okay.
Okay, and they lined up with 12 personnel, a back and 2 tight ends, and they went hard stretch zone run action to the right. And the Eagles had 8 in the box, and Malcolm Jenkins with the single high safety. And the run action did its job. Everybody flowed. Even Jenkins, the single high safety, came to that side. It was a 2-receiver route, and they ended up with Dez Bryant matched on Kerry Williams. Remember the play?
Yep. Now I know what you're talking
okay.
about.
Okay, and if you're the Cowboys, you're saying, we have Dez Bryant matched on Kerry Williams. We feel pretty good about that. And he ran the comeback,
yep.
and Williams did a great job.
Yeah, perfect.
And then on the
him.
Same yep. possession, which ended the possession, it was 3rd and 8. It was the other side of the field, and they threw the back shoulder fade to Dez.
Yep.
And it wasn't a great throw,
yep.
but the coverage was excellent.
Yep.
So we don't know what would have happened if it was a great throw, but the coverage was excellent. So on the first series, they had Dez Bryant singled up on both Williams and Fletcher, and those guys stepped up and made the plays.
Yeah.
So, you know, do we expect the Cowboys' offense overall to be as poor as it was on Thanksgiving? Probably not. But I thought the Eagles' defense did a pretty good job.
Yeah, no question about it. It's a valid point, especially, you know, considering where they were at that point. You're coming off of that Green Bay game where, listen, not a ton went right, especially in the secondary in that game. To be able to bounce back and have that kind of performance against Dez Bryant, where those guys played with good technique, you know, played disciplined on the back end. They really did a good job of playing to their help, I thought.
Right.
You know, using the safeties, using Nate Allen, using Malcolm Jenkins to their advantage. And, look, it'll be interesting to see if they're able to pull that off against Sunday night.
You know, I think ultimately, though, and I think Bill Davis has done an outstanding job overall this season, but to me, ultimately, the Eagles are fueled by their offense. And in the first Dallas game, they came out and, you know, you almost got the sense that no matter how much Dallas practiced against speed, and every team, I'm sure, tries to practice up against the up-tempo, it just seemed that they were 2 steps slower than the Eagles, particularly the first 2-3 drives. And it'll be interesting to see, now having played them once, if they still look that way. Or if they've sort of, I don't want to say adjusted, but if they just have a better feel for the tempo offense. And because I think the Eagles ultimately, we talked about this on the post game after Seattle, the Eagles to me are fueled by their offense. And if their offense can't get into that relentless rhythm, I think that impacts their entire team.
Yeah, I would agree. And let me ask you this question, because this is something that everyone's been asking me the past couple of days, so I'll kind of bounce it off of you. Is there anything that you think Dallas's defense will do differently schematically?
Right.
Than they did in the first game. Is there any? Because to me, you know, when I look at, you know, you look at their run game. Right. Their run game is what it is. They're going to run the outside zone stretch. They're going to do.
That's not going to change.
No, that's not going to change. Looking at their defense, you know, Tampa 2 team. They'll play some cover 3. They'll play some cover 2. Tampa 2. They'll mix some things up. But it's not a very complex defense in terms of variety of looks,
no.
a variety of coverages and blitzes and things like that. Do you foresee that possibly changing or?
You know, you can always say that, hey, they could play more man,
right.
but I think they would get caught a lot if they played man.
That's what happened last year.
Yeah.
They played a lot of man, and we got, you know, I remember going after Jeff Heath. They went after some of the linebackers.
Well, I think the linebackers would have a real hard time
yeah.
if they played man. So could they play more man than they did in the first matchup? They could, but I'm not sure that at this point in the season, Rod Marinelli is going to change his stripes. I think they've been... I don't want to say successful because it's not really a good defense. It's another team fueled by their offense. But this is the way they play. They have been a high-energy defense. When you watch film, you see a lot of guys flowing to the ball. So they play with high energy, good effort. But I don't think they're not a scheme defense. It's not like you play a Rex Ryan defense and each and every week you're going to see different designer blitzes and, you know, different schemes. That's not what the Dallas defense has been all year. Yes, they've had 10 days. So could there be some wrinkles? Yes, but the foundation will not change.
No, I would 100% agree. It'll be I'll be interested to see if they're able to change anything, if there's anything that they can do to try and counter what the Philadelphia Eagles like to do on offense. And I foresee the Eagles being able to move the ball like they were able to a couple Thursdays
ago. I would
ago.
Agree.
All right, let's move on to one of the hot topics in the NFL right now. It was earlier today. The Cleveland Browns announced that Johnny Manziel was going to get the start. I think it's a move that you and I would both agree needed to be made. You know, both of us have our feelings about Manziel and his abilities and his upside, I guess, as a starting NFL quarterback in the long term. But it's a move that needed to be made.
Yeah, and I think the reason it had to be made is when you watch tape of Brian Hoyer over the last number of weeks, and you know how it is. Coaches work very hard designing plays, concepts in the pass game to attack defenses. And when the play works, when you get what you want against a given defense, those balls have to be complete. And Brian Hoyer was missing those throws now. In fact, last week, he missed a couple of really big plays. He overthrew Gabriel. I don't know if you saw this play. Literally by 10 yards, and he was wide open on a deep route. He had a chance for another touchdown on what's an easy NFL throw. They set up beautifully, kind of a quick slant to Travis Benjamin, and he threw it behind him. And it would have been a touchdown if it was thrown out in front of him. So he was not executing the offense. So the change had to be made.
Sticking with the rookie quarterbacks, there was a battle in the Bay there.
Yeah.
Out west, you had San Francisco 49ers, Colin Kaepernick going up against Oakland Raiders and Derek Carr. What did you see from Carr?
Well, if you took the names off the backs of the guys and you didn't know either one, you'd say the guy playing for Oakland was so far more advanced than the guy playing for San Francisco.
Interesting.
And one of the things that I thought Carr did well in this game, which is to me a sign of his advancement, is number one, progression reading, and number two, he moved his feet with his eyes, and that is so critical to play in the NFL, because how many times do we see quarterbacks, let's say the read is to their left and they set their body left, then they realize they want to throw it a little more to the middle or the right, and they just throw it with their arm and their upper body. They don't move their feet with their eyes, and that you lose velocity and you lose accuracy when you do that. I thought that Derek Carr did a really good job in this game of moving his feet with his eyes, and that's so important because he's essentially a pocket quarterback.
Well, let me ask you this. So obviously he had his issues with, you know, being able to work in the pocket and dealing with pressure, and I think that was one of the big concerns, especially, you know, you watched that bowl game against USC, and it was the ghost of David Carr. I mean, there were issues there that I feel like obviously teams were worried about because he went in the second round. He didn't go in the first round of the draft. How is it that teams can kind of predict, this guy's going to work out, he can kind of work through these issues?
Right.
Is it a mental thing? Is it something that can be taught, or is it?
Well, it's really interesting. You say that, because I heard on TV a friend of ours, Lewis Riddick,
yep,
talk about how you always think that you can draft quarterbacks and develop them in certain ways, and sometimes guys just don't develop. And he's obviously been in scouting for a long time, and he's very smart, and you know, you look at someone like Carr, maybe he always had that in him. Maybe it was the nature of the offense he was playing in that made him play fast. Because we also saw in college, a lot of times he'd just take the ball, one step drop, and it would come out real fast, and it would be a good throw. That was sort of built into the offense. You look back at other quarterbacks who played in this similar offense, just like Blaine Gabbert.
Right.
And Blaine Gabbert was very productive in college, very similar offense, and yet he never could handle in the NFL just what we're talking about with Derek Carr. Carr seems to be handling it. And actually, he handled it right from the preseason when I started watching him. So that may just be innate to him. But I think his upside is very, very good, because the one thing he can do is really throw it well.
It's really interesting. And while we're on the topic of college prospects and transitioning to the NFL, I have one question for you. There's a guy today who declared that he was going to leave for the draft, Michigan junior. He was listed as a wide receiver this year. He was a tight end the year before, Devin Funchess. I don't know the name.
I don't know much about him.
Okay. So this is good, though. This is actually, I'm glad you don't know much about him, because you can kind of take this from from an outsider's perspective. Obviously, you'll watch a lot of tape on him as we get through the process here. But Funchess, like I said, he was listed as a tight end in 2013, moved to the wide receiver in 2014, 6'5", 230 pounds, one of these movable guys, reminds me of kind of like a Jared Cook, a Jermichael Finley, one of those.
He moves
that well. He's very impressive. But he's listed as a receiver this year. And some people will say, you look at a guy like Kelvin Benjamin, and Benjamin was, roughly around, in that body type. How much does it matter to you whether or not a guy's listed as a receiver or as a tight end? If he's going to be, regardless, he's going to be this kind of mismatch in the passing game. Does it mean too much to you whether or not he's listed as a receiver or a tight end, or at this point in his career?
No, I think you have to study the guy. I mean, the one thing you look at. Look, every receiver coming into the NFL has a lot to learn. No receiver in college runs a so-called full route tree.
Right.
Now, if you're in a more of a pro-style offense, yes, you'll have more experience doing that. Theoretically, Kelvin Benjamin had more experience than Mike Evans, let's say.
Right.
But Kelvin Benjamin is a very raw route runner who needs a lot of work. So I think it almost doesn't matter to a large extent. You'd have to see what Funches, or I'd have to see because I'm not that familiar
right.
with him,
yep.
how he moves. Obviously, there's a belief now that big wide receivers are a needed commodity. Size is a relative thing, though, because you look at Julio Jones, who obviously has had, who's some people might say he's the best wide receiver in football.
He's been nuts the last month or so.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
Yep.
And now he's not 6'5", 230, but I think he's, as I recall, he was about 6'3", 224 or something like
something
that.
Something like that,
I mean,
yep. Big guy. Yeah,
big
right.
guy.
Yeah.
And he moves so much better than a Kelvin Benjamin or a Mike Evans.
Right.
He, you know, I mean, his movement is far, far better. And he, not that he has a little man movement. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and tell you he moves like, you know, he doesn't move like, let's say, an Odell Beckham.
Right.
But his movement's really good. So you have to decide how important just the size is. I know it became very in vogue over the last 2-3 years. We all talk about it because that's the way we talk,
yep.
that big guys are open even when they're covered because they can make contested catches.
Contested catches, well, right, and the back shoulder fade and everything.
Yes and no.
Yeah.
Sometimes you see them make them and sometimes you don't. So,
and that's been one of the questions, you know, amongst people online and, you know, people that are studying the draft process
right,
right now is – whether or not he can consistently make those contested catches, because that's been an issue for him
right.
Apparently throughout the season. So it's going to be interesting as we get through. There are a lot of people that are like, nope, he's a tight end, absolutely. And there are others where say, well, what does it matter? I mean, he's going to be a mismatch in the passing game. I'm going to list him as a receiver.
And he might be.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you know, I know Evans had a stretch this year where he was really good. And, those guys at times can be really effective in the red zone. Sometimes if they're up against smaller corners, it looks like, you know, it's a pro versus a high school
Forget
kid.
About it, right.
But I think that in and of itself does not make a receiver a great NFL receiver just because he's big.
Right. All right, well, while we're talking about college guys.
Watched a lot of college football.
So I was going to ask you.
I hated the fact that there were three games on at one time.
Yeah. Would you so what did you find that you
Well, I watched
watching
the entire Alabama-Missouri game.
Okay.
And you know, the guy who's to me and we've talked about this guy. The way people start to think about quarterback. Now, is Blake Sims. Now, I'm not going to sit here and suggest as you know I wouldn't, that he's a first or second round pick. He's
yep.
obviously not.
Yeah.
But he's 6 feet tall. He ran an offense that had a lot of pro elements to it. A
ton of them, yep.
He was also asked to play fast this year, some speed tempo.
Yep.
Read option, movement. Is someone going to look at him as a fifth-round pick and say, hey, down the road, this guy can – we can use him. Again, I don't want people to fall off their chairs. You know what I'm saying.
Yep.
He's not Russell Wilson.
Right.
But can he be utilized in a similar fashion? And – I don't, to be honest with you, Fran, I don't know the answer to these questions because, you know, Russell Wilson to me in many ways is kind of an anomaly. You know, I don't think, let's put it this way, and I just mentioned Blake Sims, but there's no way that people in draft rooms or in personnel departments are sitting around saying, here's what we want a quarterback. We want a 5'11 quarterback who doesn't do a lot from the pocket, makes a lot of random improvisational plays. There's no way that they're sitting around saying that's what we want.
Right.
So Russell Wilson is obviously a very, very good player on a team that has a lot of parts. A lot of parts.
Yep.
So it's going to be interesting.
Watching Sims early in the year, you know, he had a couple of really, really impressive games. There was a stretch, I think, in the middle of the season where he kind of tapered off a little bit. I didn't get to watch the games as up close as I would have liked, so I'll get through that as we get through this, you know, the draft process here throughout the spring and the winter. But you know, I kind of felt the same way when I watched him early in the season, was look, like, this guy's got tools that theoretically
in some people's minds
are gonna fit, and in this quarterback class where, you know, it's not look, it's not a great quarterback group.
No.
You know, you've got guys, you know, that people will talk about, but ultimately it's not a great quarterback
year. And this conversation, in a sense, brings us back to Johnny Manziel.
Right.
Because in the NFL now, there's a group of what you'd probably call movement quarterbacks. Wilson, Kaepernick, Newton, is that
RG3, if you count him.
And by the way, in RG3's rookie year, they did not try to make him an NFL prototypical quarterback.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not.
He actually ran essentially a college offense. And, yes, he had great success, and now look what's happened.
And keep in mind, he was with the same offense coordinator who Johnny Manziel currently has. It'll be interesting. Will they do the same thing?
Right, right. Now, that's a fascinating point because I don't think there's anybody. It's easy now to look at Griffin where he is. But when Griffin came out versus Manziel coming out, I don't think there's anybody that would say that Manziel is a better prospect than RG3.
No, no way. Right.
Do you think anybody?
No, I don't think so at all.
So as I look and try to figure out what Johnny Manziel may or may not be, I'm trying to get a sense of, you know, what would his game be? Kaepernick is more talented. Newton's more talented. And they're bigger.
Bigger, yep.
So given that those guys have essentially leveled off, or some might say have regressed, what does that mean for that kind of quarterback? You know, Russell Wilson is obviously, as we said, is he an anomaly? Are we now basing how we evaluate quarterbacks, you know, on Russell Wilson? That would be like basing quarterbacks to me, in a sense, to some degree, on an Aaron Rodgers, who's kind of a unique player in the way he plays. You know, you really can't teach a guy how to play that way.
Right, exactly.
So, and like I said, Wilson, they know Wilson has some inconsistencies in his play, but they've got a big-time run game and a great defense.
Yep.
So they can make up for some of the inconsistencies in the game. So as I just try to figure out a guy like Manziel and where the quarterback position might be going, is it truly changing, or are we, in a sense, just coming back full circle and there'll be a few guys who are always outliers, which is true all the time in any sport?
Yeah, and I think it's been the case probably over the course of time at that position,
yeah.
Right? I mean, you can go back to any stage of the game, you know, whether you're talking late 90s or mid 2000s. I mean, there's always going to be outliers at that position, guys that may not fit the prototypical 6'4", 6'5", pocket passer that are, you know, peerless in the
look
pocket.
Look at it this way, and then we can finish up. We have benefit of a lot of things now. And once you have access to the results, it's real easy to be smart and say a lot of things. But who would be thought of higher in draft rooms coming out of college? Matthew Stafford or Russell Wilson? I don't even think it would be a conversation.
Right. Yeah, that's a valid point.
Exactly, you know, so right. It's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, no question. Well, we've got, I would say that we've got at least a few years before we can look back on this conversation and this conversation that's going to be going on for the next, you know, for the next couple seasons to be sure. So definitely very interesting stuff. Greg, I appreciate your time once again. Thanks for joining me down here at the NovaCare Complex on this beautiful, brisk Tuesday night.
At least it's not snow.
Yeah, it's not snow. That's all I keep saying, but again, thanks for joining us here on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast. Earlier today, I caught up with NFL draft insider Tony Pauline. Greg and I just talked about Michigan junior Devin Funchess. Tony and I touched on him a little bit, though it did come before he made his announcement that he was going to declare. So pardon the relevance there. But we touched on a ton of good stuff. Let's get to that interview with Tony. Joining us now on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast, my good friend Tony Pauline. You can read all of his stuff at draftinsider.net, and you could follow him on Twitter at Tony Pauline. Tony, my first question is, have you booked a room in St. Petersburg yet?
Not only booked a room, but booked airfare. All ready to go down with our buddy Adam Kaplan for the East-West Shrine game. We'll be there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday for practice. And, you know, the Shrine game is fun because as far as New York and Philadelphia is concerned, it's close proximity. You get a direct flight. You usually get nice weather. So it's always a nice respite. I enjoy that trip. And sometimes we get to see some good talent. I mean, Jimmy Garoppolo, that's where he really started his ascent up draft boards last year. So it's not a throwaway game. You do get some viable NFL prospects out of those 3 days of practice.
You know, I'm always looking for good content, you know, for the site and for everything that we do, and I still stand by the idea that a camera with you and Adam Kaplan in your hotel room for a full 2 weeks would be just gold for content for at least, you know, 3 or 4 months.
Well, you know, that should be pay-per-view, and I want to make sure that I get my hands in the till there. I get a piece of the action.
All right, Tony, usually I wait till the end of our conversation to ask you this, but I don't want to keep the people waiting this week. You're the best when it comes to keeping your ear to the grindstone. You always know who's staying in school, who's potentially coming out. You've been breaking news on this podcast all season long. You brought up Senquez Rollins, the cornerback from Miami, Ohio, a few weeks back. He wasn't on Scott's radar to start the season. He got a Senior Bowl invite. What's the latest you're hearing on Rollins?
Yeah, I'm hearing that there is a wide variety of opinions as to where he could fall in the draft. Some people think he's a late-round pick, but there are some scouts out there who stamp him as a potential second-round selection. So this guy could, you know, potentially fall into the top 60 choices. I mean, he's got excellent size. He's a basketball player. He's a great athlete who has made an easy transition to the cornerback position. So when we go to the Senior Bowl and we watch him play at the Senior Bowl, those one-on-one drills, you know, people say, well, you know, you don't do seven-on-sevens, you don't do one-on-ones, but, you know, that'll be very important for a guy like Rollins, because if he proves that he can withstand or he can stand up against some of the top senior receivers and top senior quarterbacks, although the senior quarterback class is not that good, if he plays well at the Senior Bowl, this guy's got an opportunity going from someone who no one knew in the football world in August to a potential second or third round pick in the 2015 draft.
Well, Tony, you brought up the Senior Bowl, and I hear that you're hearing some different things that could be going on with the schedule down there in Mobile this spring.
Yeah, traditionally, I mean, ever since I started going to the Senior Bowl back in 2000, it was the players and the scouts and the teams arrived on Sunday, except for the teams that were in the championship game. They would arrive on Monday. Monday morning, you'd have your weigh-ins, and then Monday there'd be a split practice. Tuesday and Wednesday there would be practice, and Wednesday was the big practice day. That was the day that, you know, really filled up the sideline with coaches, general managers, scouts, etc. It's going to change this year, from what I understand. The players and the teams are going to arrive on Monday. The practices start and the weigh-ins start Tuesday. Tuesday morning, from what I'm told, will be the weigh-ins. There will be a split practice on Tuesday, so people who are there can see both practices. There will be practice Wednesday, then Thursday. In the past, Thursday was a no pads practice day, and Friday was a walkthrough. It's not going to happen. Thursday is going to be the big day of practice. Friday is going to be a walkthrough. Saturday will be game time. So it basically everything is pushed back, except for the game itself. The practice schedule has been pushed back one day.
Tony, why do you think those changes have been made? What's the reasoning behind it?
You know, I don't think that we're ever going to get an absolute reason. If you're asking me to speculate, I think what happens is after Wednesday's practice, if a player's got, you know, a nicked up ankle or sore hamstring, he doesn't play in the game, because all they do is basically sit around Thursday and Friday, and the game comes Friday. I think what they're trying to do is, and in the past, you know, it's created some problems because they got to shuffle players in at the last minute to fill the roster, to fill a depth chart. So, you know, speculatively, I think it kind of cuts the time between the last practice and the actual game. This way players are like, all right, I'll hang out the extra day and play in the game, because I know recently, you know, you see there's a large turnover from Monday's first practice to the game day on Saturday.
That's a good thought. I actually never thought about it that way, so that's a pretty good idea by you. But before we get into the rest of the discussion, I wanted to talk about some of these juniors that may or may not be coming out. And before we wanted to get into that, I just wanted to throw my feelings out there about these underclassmen. I think, you know, things have kind of gone the way that things have gone the last couple of seasons. It's a shame. A lot of these guys have left school early, jumped into the league, haven't caught on for a number of reasons, mostly because they just weren't ready. You know, I think players, unless the draft advisory board gives a first or second round grade, should absolutely just stay in school. Obviously, there are special cases, but, you know, I just wanted to preface the rest of the conversation with my general feelings on that. But let's get into it. One guy you've talked about in the past is possibly leaning towards entering the draft, LSU junior defensive back Jalen Collins. He's 6'2", 205, a versatile guy that plays with an edge. What's the latest on Collins, and do you think he's coming out?
A lot of people say he's going to come out, and a lot of people say he'd be better off, you know, staying for an extra year of development on the field. LSU has a history of underclassmen, you know, entering the draft in droves, as we've seen the past years, especially in the defensive backfield. He's shown skill. He needs some technique work. He needs more consistency. You know, LSU just has a way of growing those bigger, physical, aggressive cornerbacks that can play at the next level. Looks like he's going to be the next one. I think the difference is, you know, if he comes out this year, he's probably more of a mid to late round pick, where if he goes back and has another year and really proves that he's the real deal and can consistently play at a high level, then all of a sudden in 2016, He's a top 45 pick. I don't think he's going to go that high moving forward, but you never know because the cornerback class looks very weak this year.
Well, while we're discussing underclassmen, Tony, one theme that's prevalent every single year when it comes to juniors entering the draft is the group of guys that come from teams that have just lost their head coach after being fired at the end of the regular season. So I'll bring up some of these big openings around the country. You let me know if there are potential names that have yet to make their intentions known and what your thoughts are on those guys. First, let's start with Florida. Will Muschamp was the first big-name coach to find out he wouldn't be with his team next year. As a result, we've seen guys like Dante Fowler announce he was coming out. You put out there last week that linebacker Antonio Morrison may make the jump. Are there any other names right now that fans should be aware of?
Yeah, and they had really a second-rate offensive lineman who's going to enter the draft who probably won't be selected. As you said, I mentioned Morrison, the outside linebacker. Matt Jones, the running back from Florida, is expected to leave. DJ Humphreys, the offensive lineman who's lined up at both tackle and offensive guard, is also expected to leave. And then there's Jonathan Bullard, the defensive lineman, who's a three-technique potential three-man defensive end up front. He's also likely to leave. I hear he's been pulling back the past couple of weeks since they got their new head coach in there. But I do believe you're going to see a large exodus or a larger-than-usual exodus of underclassmen from Florida into the NFL draft.
All right, well, next up, let's look at Nebraska. The big name here is obviously Randy Gregory, possible top five pick. We've talked about him in the past. With Bo Pelini out, has his status changed, or is he a definite to jump into this draft class?
I'd be more surprised if he stayed than if he entered the draft. Mike Riley's really going to have to do some major campaigns, some major re-recruiting to get him back. But I think all along, Gregory's plan was this was his last year at Nebraska, and why not? I mean, a lot of people thought he was NFL-ready last year, or if he wasn't NFL-ready, if he entered the draft, he's a second- or third-round pick, and he's jumped into the top five. I mean, it'll be a situation for Randy Gregory. Does he want to stay in Nebraska and potentially get his degree versus start his NFL career? That's the decision he's going to have to make. I would be much more shocked if he decided to stay in college for another year as opposed to entering the draft, which everyone is assuming the case right now.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. I mean, when these new head coaches come in, they really, it's almost like they have to recruit. Obviously, they're recruiting high school kids to come to their school, but they have to recruit some of these juniors to make them want to stay with the program. I was there at Temple when, Al Golden left. He went down to Miami. Steve Adazio came in, and you had Muhammad Wilkerson, who was very highly thought of junior. And he, it was a recruiting pitch. You had to try and keep him there. Now, he ended up making the right decision. He ended up going to the NFL, was a first-round pick, and became one of the best defensive linemen in the league right now as he's playing for your hometown Jets. But it's really one of the more interesting things you're going to be following here as some of these new head coaches, Mike Riley at Nebraska, Jim McElwain at Florida, will try and recruit these guys to stay at home.
Well, it's not just new coaches, but existing coaches have to re-recruit. Not only have to recruit not only high school guys into the program, but have to re-recruit some of their stars to stay. And, I mean, one of the better ones is Dabo Sweeney. I mean, he got Beasley to stay for another year. If you remember, C.J. Spiller was out the door as a junior, and Dabo Sweeney was able to talk him to come back for another year. So a lot of these coaches, I mean, sometimes guys at Alabama, Nick Saban at Alabama doesn't have to worry about it because he's got so much talent. But a lot of the head coaches, I mean, they recruit these guys into their program, and then they have to re-recruit them to stay at the program. So it's not just a new coach phenomena. It's basically existing coaches as well.
All right, well, at Michigan, Brady Hoke was let go last week. How has that decision affected the plans for Devin Funchess? We've talked about this kid in the past. Some see him as a wideout. Others see him as a tight end. Regardless of how you see him, he's a matchup nightmare in the passing game, will likely be a high draft pick when he does decide to enter, whether that's this year or next year.
I don't think it affects his plans at all. In fact, I believe we talked about in the past, the word was out that he's already decided on an agent back in October. So I think Funchess is long gone. I would assume that he's going to make his announcement relatively, in a timely manner. I don't think it's going to come down to the wire. But it's been put out there and it's been pretty much well known that he's already decided on who his agent's going to be. And I think what's going on in Michigan right now kind of just gives him an easier time of walking out the door.
Are there any other names from Michigan that fans should be aware of?
No. I mean, part of the problem why the program has been down the past couple of years is just the lack of talent. So I don't see any other top-rated underclassmen entering the draft from that program because there really are no, except for Funchess, are no really top-rated guys that are going to make an impact in the top two rounds of the draft.
Well, Mike Riley surprised a lot of people leaving Oregon State for Nebraska. That was a senior-laden team. Obviously, they didn't have as great of a year this year as they did last year when they had guys like Brandon Cooks, who was a first-round pick. Let me ask you this. We haven't talked about him since the start of the year. What's the latest buzz on Obum Gwakum, the former wideout turned pass rusher for the Beavers? What are scouts saying about this kid at this point in the process?
Yeah, more flash than consistency. You know, a guy who has never really a lot of people wanted to focus on him. A lot of people like him. He's got the raw tools, but he really hasn't developed as opposed to, say, the way Ziggy Ansah has. You know, he's been a spot starter. He's been moved in and out of the starting lineup. He's a guy who can make plays up the field, but he's got a long ways to go. He was a guy who potentially could have developed into a second or third round, but as of right now, he's more of a late-round type of project. I'd be surprised. Maybe he gets an invite to the East-West Shrine Game. I do think he probably will get an invite to the Combine, but, you know, it's someone that people were just waiting for him to have that breakout game and then build upon it. Never happened.
All right, let me ask you another question about another senior. Cameron Irving from Florida State, former left tackle, shifted inside to center because of inconsistent play inside for the Seminoles. He's been lights out since the switch, and he's really looked good inside. When he was a tackle, there was a question about whether or not he would hold up on the edge at the next level. Now that he's looked so good inside, do you think that's the position that teams will look at him most come the spring?
Well, let's hope he goes to the Senior Bowl, and I think that will really be the final what will dictate where he plays at the next level. I think that game against Clemson, when Vic Beasley just housed him the entire game, just, you know, really had him playing back on his heels and spinning around, really hurt Irving. The fact is if you can play left tackle, the left tackle position is more of a priority, more important in the NFL than the center position. It's not that the center position isn't important. It's just that you need a guy who can protect the edge. And, you know, Irving, a former defensive end, had shown a lot of progress and a lot of potential up until really the beginning of the season when he started to struggle. I think what happens is if he's smart, he goes to the Senior Bowl. If he goes to the Senior Bowl and he does well at the left tackle position and people come away thinking, yep, this guy can play left tackle, he's going to go much higher in the draft than if he was at the center spot.
Florida State, I mean, obviously they made it into the playoffs. They made it into that Final Four. Full of talent. They've got a ton of seniors on that team, Rashad Green, Carlos Williams, some of these guys along the offensive line. But they've got a lot of juniors as well. Are there any guys that fans should be aware of that may make the jump to the NFL?
Well, I think there's going to be several, and you start with the two cornerbacks, P.J. Williams and Ronald Darby, two players who a lot of people thought were going to be first-round picks. They've really struggled this year. If you watch that Louisville game, I mean, Devontae Parker, I believe that was Parker's first game back from injury. You know, just really made them look foolish. I mean, they were spinning. They were getting turned. They were getting beat left and right, especially P.J. Williams. I think the big news out of Florida State is it's a weak cornerback crop. People thought that Williams and Darby would assist them in moving the talent north. And while they do, not too many people view either of those guys as first-round talent. So, you know, you look at the mock drafts around. A lot of times they have these guys in the top 20. P.J. Williams right now at Florida State is out of the first round. He's got some off-the-field issues. He's got some character concerns. He really hasn't played that well this year. So that's the big news coming out of Florida State.
What about up front? You got guys like Mario Edwards and Eddie Goldman. I mean, they bring these guys in waves up front at Florida State. Any of these other guys, you have any kind of sense of whether or not they're going to stay in school?
I've not heard it. Mario Williams, I know I took a lot of grief in the beginning of the year because I had him rated as a late-round pick. People thought he was a first-rounder. You know, he plays in flashes. He plays in streaks. He's a beast of a human. I mean, he's a monster, man, but he doesn't play like it. He doesn't consistently force the action. You look at him, and you see an athlete, but you see an athlete who doesn't really make a lot of plays. Does Mario Edwards, you know, enter the draft? Hopefully his dad says stay in school another year, because if he does enter the draft, you know, it could be like the Goldstein kid from Michigan State, who everyone early on thought was a second-round pick, but it was a guy who just never produced on the field and was more, you know, reputation than reality, and fell into the later rounds.
Proverbial gun to your head, Jameis Winston, is he staying or is he going?
I think he's gone. Either he's going to go or Florida State is going to say to him, thanks for what you did. We enjoyed having you around, but you probably should take your career to the next level because he's becoming too much of a distraction. Sadly, I mean, the guy seems to be his own worst enemy at times. I mean, a lot of these things are self-inflicted, which is really bothersome to see. And the thing is when you watch Winston on film, he really hasn't improved his game this year. I mean, he's a great athlete. He can make all the throws in or out of the pocket, make plays with his arms or his legs, but just the untimely interceptions this season, the interceptions that really forced Florida State into a comeback situation, kept the opponents in the game. I think he struggled at times. I think he would really benefit from another year in school, and I don't think he's going to go as early as many people think. But I would be very surprised if he does not, if he stays at Florida State as opposed to entering the draft. He's also a very good baseball player, so that's something also to keep in mind.
Tony, great stuff as always. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us this week on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast here on PhiladelphiaEagles.com. Take care. We'll see you in a couple weeks here.
Look forward to it, Fred.
All right, so that'll do it for this week. Another show in the books here on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast. Thanks so much to Greg Cosell and Tony Pauline for joining me as we prepare for Sunday night's game against the Dallas Cowboys. Thanks to all of you that listen out there. Give us great feedback on Twitter. Keep spreading the word. For my producer, BT, I'm Fran Duffy. We'll talk to you next week.
Anything that moves, I don't care who it is. Let's go. Give me everything you got. Play fast, play hard. Let's beat these boys tonight in their house.
It's party time. It's party time.
Dad, here we go.
Touchdown.